Hey there, listener, and welcome back to the Professionally Cannabis Podcast. Today, we'll be featuring a slightly different episode. Having received a few notes from newer listeners keen to understand more about individual cannabinoids, I thought it would be cool this week to play out a session that I ran last year at the GCI Summit with none other than Dr. Ethan Russo. As one of the modern-day OGs of cannabis research and science, it is always an absolute pleasure to pick the brain of Ethan, who is an unequivocal authority on the plant and its constituent parts. Over the session, we'll do a whistle-stop tour of a number of minor cannabinoids, examining their therapeutic potential and roadblocks that can affect cannabis research. As a heads up, the session was initially recorded on Zoom, so the audio quality will be slightly different to the typical pods. However, I'm sure that hearing the wonderful insights of Dr. Russo will be enough of an audio feast to nullify any tinniness, if that's a word. Anywho, enough of me and more of Dr. Russo discussing minor cannabinoids.
Could you talk us through the cannabinoid CBG? What are the current applications of this in research and consumer goods? And what is the promise and potential behind it?
Yeah, well, I'm so glad to have this opportunity. I think CBG, cannabigerol, is the next big thing in cannabis therapeutics. It's got a fascinating history, if I could digress for a moment, in that it was discovered with the other phytocannabinoids, plant-based cannabinoids, in the early 60s. But because it wasn't overtly intoxicating the way that THC was, it was largely ignored. There were some people that even thought it inactive. Another contributing factor to that was cannabigerol is normally not found in very great concentrations in cannabis. Normally, its parent compound, the cannabigerolic acid, is made in the plant. It's just a short way station on the way to production of cannabidiolic acid and tetrahydrocannabinolic acid, the parent compounds of THC and CBD. So that's another reason that it was largely ignored. Often in the early assays, they didn't even notice the amount of cannabigerol present. But to answer your question, this really, research on it picked up probably about 20 years ago. On a lot of this work was sponsored by GW Pharmaceuticals, where I worked, and they supported a lot of basic science studies on CBG. It showed great promise because of a number of mechanisms of action. So while it doesn't really bind particularly to the cannabinoid receptors, CB1 and CB2, the way THC does, there were a great number of other activities. It has activity on GABA receptors, which can influence both muscle tone and anxiety. Additionally, it works as an antagonist of the TRPM8 receptor, which makes it a great candidate for treatment of prostate cancer, but also some other bladder problems. It also works on keratinocytes in the skin that would make it a potential treatment for psoriasis. And the list goes on and on. My team and I, this is along with Carrie Cutler, Michelle Sexton, and associates, we've recently done a very extensive survey of use of cannabigerol in the USA. In recent years, there's been an effort to cultivate high CBG chemovars, chemical varieties of cannabis, and actually, there are probably several hundred hectares under cultivation, particularly in the state of Oregon. So this has become available, and we thought it was time to do a survey of what patients were gaining from use of cannabigerol predominant preparations. So we put together a survey which went online, and we got 127 responses from people that completed the whole survey and were only using material that was at least 50% CBG, not trace amounts, as might be present in other types of cannabis. The results were very illuminating, if we could go into them.
Yes, please, please, absolutely.
Well, there was a long list of conditions that people mentioned. Primary among them were pain, sleep, depression, and anxiety. But there were also people with migraine, nausea, irritable bowel syndrome, osteoarthritis, fibromyalgia, or using it as an anti-inflammatory. And almost uniformly, they reported good results. Paramount among them were pain, sleep, depression, and anxiety, where people were asked to compare these to the results they'd had using conventional medicines for the same conditions. And almost uniformly, they preferred the CBG. So that's the plus side, but you always have to examine the negative side. What were the adverse events? And here, people found it relatively benign. There were very few side effects reported. Additionally, nobody reported any withdrawal symptoms when they might have used it and then stopped. Nobody reported anything that really suggested a dependency liability with this, as might occur with other drugs. So we're very excited about this. We hope that this will be a prelude to randomized controlled trials of cannabigerol preparations for these various medical conditions. There's one I forgot to mention, another property of CBG that's really fascinating, and that is it's a very powerful antibiotic for gram-positive infections, and this includes MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. So this is also effects on vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. So these are some of your antibiotic-resistant infections that are plaguing hospital-based practices. I think this is an extremely exciting prospect that really needs to get into the clinics ASAP.
And you mentioned that CBG doesn't bind particularly well to the CB1 or CB2 receptors. So would I be right in saying that in terms of someone taking CBG, would it be better in conjunction with other cannabinoids that do bind well to these receptors? Or is it the results you're looking at, are they better sort of in isolation?
Well, you've set me up for this, I think. I feel that all the cannabinoids work better in concert with other cannabinoids and terpenoids. So no matter what the issue, there are always ways that things can be refined. It certainly would be the case that CBG alone would be a promising candidate. But, I'm of the philosophy that nature does it better. And if we're starting with a high CBG chemovar or even a CBG-only chemovar, and these do exist, with the complement of other ingredients such as the terpenoids, I really expect that these can produce better results. For example, if we're looking at MRSA, we also know that pinene and limonene have effects on the staph infection. So, to look for synergy, and if that's proven in laboratory analysis, then it's a good thing to include when we get to the point of treating people or even animals with these agents.
Well, it looks like absolutely that will be the next big thing as far as the cannabinoids go. But similar question and looking at THCV, where are we seeing the greatest application of this? And ultimately, what do you believe it's good for?
Sure. Again, if I may, a little bit of background. So THCV is the propyl analog of THC. In other words, it's got a 3-carbon side chain instead of 5. This is found in small amounts, very low concentrations, in accessions from southern Africa. But again, until about 20 years ago, when selective breeding was done by Atinda Meyer at GW Pharmaceuticals, it was never available in significant amounts, let alone a majority of the cannabinoid content. So again, this was researched, and its pharmacology is fascinating in that at low or moderate doses, it's a neutral antagonist on the CB1 receptor. So it can allay hunger and has been researched in animals successfully to reduce intake in obese mice, and also have positive effects on laboratory parameters associated with the metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes mellitus. So great promise there, but that's not all, as they say in the ads. It additionally, it will flip to being an agonist at high concentrations, but these shouldn't be necessary medically. Like the other cannabinoids, it has benefits on some cancer cell lines. It is effective in treatment of neuropathic pain in animal experiments. And it's also an anticonvulsant. So what's not to like? You know, in terms of effects that people might run into, again, usually even so-called varieties from Africa mostly have very little amount of THCV, but consumers sometimes report that it's a higher, a clearer high or a quicker high with a quicker offset. But this hasn't been formally looked at in double-blind experiments. An agent of great promise. And there is an effort now around the world, again, to do selective breeding to maximize concentrations of THCV.
So potentially this is a cannabinoid that could be applied in significant proportions for medical patients that are looking for really rapid onset of the effects of their cannabis. Is that right?
Well, perhaps. But, you know, again, for quicker onset, we'd look at inhalation. I think the real value is going to be in the development of a safe agent to allay hunger and treat metabolic syndrome and diabetes. Now, again, it's important that we emphasize here, this is quite distinct from prior drugs like rimonabant, SR141716A, which was an agent that was passed through the European Medicine Agency briefly as a weight loss drug, but it was what is known as an inverse agonist at the CB1 receptor. What that means is it just doesn't bind to the receptor, but it actually knocks down the activity of the endocannabinoid system in general. So what happened was something that some of us really expected before its release, and that was it had a tremendous adverse event liability in terms of producing depression and anxiety wasn't there where it wasn't there before. There were a couple of new cases of MS in people previously not affected. Potentially, it could reduce seizure threshold, make seizures more likely. You go on and on and on. So what happened after rimonabant was taken off the market in the European Union was that there were probably several Me Too drugs by other companies that were in development with the same mechanism of action. And that was just stopped cold. You know, it was realized that this is a road you shouldn't go down. You don't want to knock down the activity of the endocannabinoid system in general. It's a recipe for disaster. But it's a sobering reminder that when you're affecting basic drives like hunger, there can be repercussions. Now, the distinction is important. THCV, as a neutral antagonist, doesn't decrease the overall gain, if you will, of the endocannabinoid system, doesn't reduce endocannabinoid tone. And from what we know, whether in animals or humans, it has none of the liabilities that were encountered with rimonabant and similar drugs. So while I'm sure regulatory agencies are going to be quite vigilant about such associated side effects, I think that we have excellent evidence that those really will not come to pass.
And now, Ethan, moving on to Delta-8 THC, and this is a cannabinoid that has gained a lot of press in recent months, probably due to its regulatory ambiguity, I'd say.
I'm very happy to have the opportunity to address this. There's a Delta-8 THC craze going on in the U.S. right now. I'm afraid that this is based on a bunch of misconceptions. But let's start at the beginning. What is Delta-8 THC? Well, regular THC is delta 9 THC. It just means that there's a little switch in position. But what we know about delta 8, and again, we don't have a lot of formal testing in humans, so with an exception I'll get to, but it is a partial agonist at the CB1 receptor, like delta 9. It is felt, but not yet demonstrated, that it might be a little less potent. Online, there are all kinds of claims that it doesn't produce the same level of anxiety that delta 9 THC does. But what has happened is, with the so-called Farm Bill in the U.S., there's been an interpretation, an erroneous one, I would add, by many people that delta 8 that is produced in the lab from CBD, this conversion from CBD to delta 8 THC, that it would be legal because the original source as hemp was legal. But this is totally erroneous. In fact, it's clear from the Controlled Substances Act that when you take hemp and start dickering with it to produce other things, that you're in a clear illegal zone. Additionally, there's additional legislation in the U.S., the Analogs Act, that means if you're making something that is an analog of something that's Schedule One and forbidden, the same is true of what you produced. Now, that neglects what medical benefits it might have. The best study was one out of Israel in the 90s, Abrahamov and et al. They used delta 8 THC to treat nausea and vomiting in a group of children who were undergoing chemotherapy for cancer. And the results were uniformly beneficial in allaying nausea and vomiting in this population. And there was very little in the way of psychoactive effects. Now, we have to couple that with the knowledge that kids under 10 don't usually manifest the psychoactivity of THC in general to the same extent as adults. I mean, some people think that kids are just naturally stoned. But the fact is, and this has been well documented going back to the 19th century, that younger children tolerate doses of THC that would clearly cause problems in an adult. On the plus side, delta 8, because it's more stable than delta 9 THC, may have good medical applications, but no one should be fooled into thinking that this is a loophole legally around the illegality of cannabis in most jurisdictions. So it's unfortunate that we've got this craze going on. Some state legislatures have moved to make delta 8 illegal. I expect at some point there'll be federal directed attention to this issue. People are really, they're grasping at opportunities motivated by financial gain, I'm sure, but the legal issue is clear.
And if you believe it to be somewhat of a regulatory dodge, this recent craze around delta THC, do you think there's any way that the sort of bad press around that might stifle developments in research on the medical side for this cannabis?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is the same story we keep seeing, and this is one reason I'm coming down so hard on this. Yeah, this is a potentially therapeutic molecule, its efforts to investigate it properly and get it to patients who might benefit from its use are going to be stymied by all this mishigas, to use a Yiddish word, associated with the delta 8 craze. Now, I should mention one other thing that's important. This is not an artificial component. With advanced analytical techniques, it's been shown that delta 8 is a natural component of cannabis in lesser amounts, but there's some varieties where it seems to be in equal amounts to THC. It's just that previously, the analytics weren't sophisticated enough to separate the two. They have the same molecular weight, they're analogs. And so telling the difference between them is a bit technically challenging, but it is 2021 and the capability is there now with the proper equipment.
Now, Ethan, moving on, could you take us through the acid form of both THC and CBD, big THCA and CBDA? These will be cannabinoids that some folks might be familiar with, but some others might not.
Right. Well, we've got a recurring theme here. So the ignored cannabinoids, for decades, THC took up all the bandwidth. And again, it was thought that these acid precursors of the neutral cannabinoids were inactive, and that was never true. It's just, again, in the 60s, science didn't have the sophistication, nor particularly the curiosity to look at them more closely. So THCA is the form that cannabis plant makes before its decarboxylation by heat, light, or aging into THC. But it's not inactive. Again, a fascinating molecule. Seemingly, it probably doesn't bind to the CB1 receptor. But because it's unstable, in a lot of the examinations of this, some of the THC, some is decarboxylated and produces results that suggest that THCA does act on the receptor. Also, THCA shouldn't pass the blood-brain barrier. If we look at test animals for seizure threshold, it took huge amounts to produce any effect. And yet people are using THCA in severe epilepsy to advantage. But that's easily explained by the fact that in these severe epilepsies, there's a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier that allows it to enter. Well, what else is it doing? Well, there are two key things that THCA does that obviously render it a therapeutic alternative. One is that it works on tumor necrosis factor alpha, which is a very important target in autoimmune disorders. So that'd be Crohn's disease, other inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, rheumatoid arthritis, and even multiple sclerosis. So that's one target. And then a few years ago, it was noted by Nadal et al. In Spain that THCA is a pretty strong agonist at the PPAR gamma receptor. This is a nuclear receptor that affects gene transcription, and it makes it a great candidate for treatment of certain cancers, also in treating the metabolic syndrome and weight gain kinds of issues, among others. And there are many people using this to advantage for a wide variety of disorders. It's pretty potent. You don't need a lot. It's been hindered somewhat by the fact that, as mentioned, it's not particularly stable. Professor Mashulam is subjecting it to an esterification process that does make it stable and allows then, it acts as a prodrug so that THCA will last longer. But I think that there's still applications for raw cannabis with THCA itself. If I may, turning to CBDA, this would be the form that hemp makes. So again, precursor to CBD after decarboxylation. It has some things in common with CBD, but tends to be much more potent. Our team established back in 2005 that CBD works as an agonist at the serotonin 1A receptor, but CBDA is somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times more potent than CBD. So whereas CBD often requires very high doses to treat anxiety and other conditions, CBD seemingly, at least in the animal work that's been done, is very effective. Could be effective in anxiety, effective as an antiemetic for nausea and vomiting. So again, very promising. And both THCA and CBDA seem to have great promise in treatment of a variety of types of cancer. With THCA, more demonstrated. With CBDA, it hasn't been investigated much, but the European Renaissance herbalist sure recommended raw hemp to treat a variety of tumors. And I think that really lends credence to the possible application there as well.
And Ethan, as our time starts drawing to a close, perhaps a final cannabinoid that I'd love us to dig into. And the cannabinoid that really seems to have huge potential for a variety of indications and conditions is CBC. However, obtaining the right quantities to propel research forward can be really quite tricky. How can this be remedied? And are there certain cultivars that can yield a higher percentage of CBC?
Yes. So what's the problem here? In the past, it was people had trouble in the lab telling the difference between CBC and CBD. And some of the old literature will say that CBC was the second most common cannabinoid in cannabis after THC, which is erroneous. What we know now is its parent compound, cannabichrominic acid, is formed only as a recessive trait. That's as opposed to the codominant enzymes that produce THC and CBD. So it's a recessive gene. We don't see it very much, often not at all in most varieties of cannabis. It can be selectively bred, but another quirk is its expression is greater in immature plants. So it's quite contrary to what we usually see with cannabis, whereas you wait until full maturity of the unfertilized female flowers before harvest. My colleague David Potter at GW Pharmaceuticals developed a technique basically making hashish out of immature CBC predominant plants to maximize yield. So this kind of technique could be applied, but selective breeding is really the answer, unless you're of the camp that believes that we should be producing these things in yeast or E. coli. I'm not in that camp. Again, I think the plant does it better and more efficiently, as well as producing desirable entourage compounds. But in terms of what it does, CBC is really promising. It shares a lot of features with CBD in that it may increase endocannabinoid tone. It is anti-inflammatory, analgesic, seemingly has indications that it would be helpful for depression. And again, antibiotic effects, anti-cancer effects. So plenty to be done there. Yes, it's been hard to have enough of this. High enough concentrations in the past, but with proper attention to selective breeding, using standard techniques without necessarily relying on genetic modification, this should be more available in the future.
Well, Ethan, I'd like to say thank you so much for joining us on this session and sharing your insights.
My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.